You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We have a wonderful special guest for our interview tonight. I've been trying for years and years and years to get this wonderful guest on our radio show. It's scheduled to not permit this until tonight. Please welcome to Wake Up Hollywood, Mr. Joe Bosey. How are you, man?
Hey, how are you? Good.
Dude, you're like, yeah, how are you?
that was a nice intro.
Well, dude, you know, a lot of people don't know that you and I are great friends. We both know it. But, you know, there are a few people that I see so eye to eye with when it comes to music. And it's so incredible because you are the finishing touch for everything that I do musically. And I couldn't tell you that I don't trust anybody more than you with something that is so close to my heart and soul. And I have to tell you, honestly, I trust you implicitly. And that is also something I don't always do. So thank you, first of all, for just having the ears and the ability and experience that you do, because, man, it's like I learn from you and I admire and respect you tremendously. And your work is beyond incredible, and I know that you and I are going to make music forever, so I just thank you endlessly for that. So first I want to say that.
Oh wow. That's great.
Now I want to get into the nitty-gritty. You've been a musician, you're a wonderful mastering engineer. We're gonna get into all these artists that you've mastered. You've mastered Outkast, Speaker Box, U2, How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb, Britney Spears, you know, endless huge artists, and you've done a ton of indie artists, but where did your love of music, what was that moment of Zen? What made you fall in love with music from the very beginning?
Well my dad was a radio station programmer.
Hey, I'm hearing myself delayed.
Oh, you're good on our end. You're okay. Good on our end.
My dad was a radio station program director when I was a kid. So I grew up in a house full of music. My parents were both musicians. They met in a band when they were at the University of Arizona.
That's amazing.
So, yeah. So, I mean, I was born into music, I guess. Like, I remember being a kid and sitting under the console in a recording studio in Detroit while my dad was recording bands and, you know, stuff like that. And there was always guitars and drums and harmonicas and like all over the house. We had a room in our house. My dad had a barber chair in the middle of, and it was floor to wall to ceiling LPs that awesome. he would bring home from the radio station. So I would pick the ones with the coolest covers and just listen to album after album after album.
And what was like one of the first records that you remember going, this is awesome? The cover or the
Beach Boys, Endless Summer, I think it was called.
Yeah.
And Fleetwood Mac Rumors. I was probably about 10 when that album came
out. Those are extraordinary records for an adult to listen to. You're a 10-year-old kid and you just knew right away it was great?
Oh, I was listening to Emerson, Lake & Palmer records because they had the coolest album covers. And I was 10 and it had like an armadillo tank. You know, it was like half armadillo, half tank. And I'm like, this has got to be cool.
I remember seeing records like, you know, for me, it was Simon and Garfunkel, Bridge Over Troubled Water, and hearing like how crazy good that was. And it was like Journey, Men at Work, Thriller, and, you know, just like.
I remember when the album Thriller came out, I was at one of my dad's friends' houses for Christmas. And he brought that album out and he played it like A-side, B-side, we listened to the whole album.
Well, what's so crazy, you work at the mastering lab where that came out of, and you're amongst the greatness of all these amazing mastering engineers like Bernie Grumman, which is how we met.
Yeah, he mastered that.
Which is incredible. So, like, you listen to that record back, and like notice more things now, because I feel like when I, you know, as I grow older, I go back and listen to records that I fell in love with as a kid, and I hear so much more on those records. Or does it feel like it was always an explosion of sound? You just kind of like always listen.
Oh no, those records in particular are pop recording perfection.
Yes, I agree.
You didn't get any better than that.
What other records did you listen? Did you put on that you were like, "Oh my god, this is"? What was the moment you were like, "I want to be a musician" or "I want to work in this field"?
That probably didn't come from putting records on. I also went to a lot of concerts when I was a kid because my dad had access to that as well, and I had access to backstage.
And this is in Canada, correct?
Well, we were living in Canada, but it was in Detroit.
Oh wow,
Detroit,
Music
Michigan.
City, man.
So, I mean, I saw everybody. And I remember seeing ELO and Supertramp and Bryan Adams and Journey and Kiss. I mean, just who's who.
How was Supertramp? They're one of the bands I always wish I could have seen.
Oh, it was great. Breakfast in America. I think everybody knows every word to most of that record. So that was fun.
And Journey, you saw them with Steve Perry.
Oh yeah,
which is like a rarity. You'll never see that again.
My dad, later on in life, my dad had his own record label, and Jonathan Cain, who's the keyboard player in Journey, was one of the artists that was on my dad's record label.
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah. So your dad obviously loved music and kind of cultivated
the
house. Did he ever play? He played guitar. He was in a band. You said
he played bass in a band, a couple different bands. He played in rock bands. He played in folk bands. I mean, that's how he got into the industry as a musician.
And your mom was a singer guitarist?
Yep, she was a singer.
Did they ever write together?
Oh, yeah, man.
Dude, did you guys ever have a family band?
They were a four-piece folk band house act at a casino in Las Vegas for like
oh
5 years.
God, that's awesome. What was the name of the band? Do you remember?
The Young Lions or something?
Oh, yeah, dude.
That's what it was.
That's awesome. Yeah. The Young Lions.
Yeah, I've actually mastered some of that stuff for my dad and my mom. My brother and I have. We've taken all the music that they recorded and made, you know, CDs for them of their stuff.
Wait, so they still have the reels of tape? All that
stuff? No, they didn't have reels of tape, but they had a couple 45s. Actually, I think my dad might have had some reels.
Wow.
And my mom had a bunch of stuff that she'd done that had been pressed onto albums. So we took the albums and loaded them into the computer and cleaned everything up. And
that must have been such a gift for them to hear that like all over again, right?
Yeah, it's cool. For sure.
And when did you start playing guitar and start learning an instrument?
I don't remember not playing the guitar. So
that's awesome.
From as old as I was able to hold one, I was ruining my dad's guitars.
Like acoustic, electric, didn't matter?
I still have my dad had a steel string and a nylon string, and he wouldn't let me touch his steel string acoustic guitar. So I learned how to play on a nylon string acoustic, and I still have it.
Dude, that's one thing we have in common. That's what I learned on. I learned on an old Yamaha nylon string, and it's still like a cherished guitar, but
it's
old
Yamaha nylon string.
Dude, no way, really?
Yeah, it is.
See, we're connected. This is why we see eye to eye. We started with the roots in the same place. So what did he have as a steel string guitar?
Oh, geez. You know, I don't, it's still in the case under his bed, I'll bet. I think it's a Guild.
Oh my God. Sure.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably worth a pretty penny. He should take that.
Yeah, that's why he never let me touch it. I mean, I think I spent his coin collection on chocolate bars in the fourth grade, and I never got to touch anything again.
That's awesome. Yeah. Did you start playing electric guitar soon after? Were you like...
My first electric guitar was believe it or not, I got it at a garage sale, and I didn't know what it was. I thought it was a Dobro.
Oh, wow.
So, and then I got a lap steel. And I was like, why can't I play chords on this thing?
Dude, the action is so high.
My dad, for I think it was like right around 10 or 11, my dad bought me an Ibanez Roadstar. And it was like a Steve Lukather model guitar.
Yep, I know.
And
exactly.
I loved that guitar. I wish I still had it. If I ever see that guitar again, I will buy it.
You know what? I never hear of somebody that says, they are very happy they sold an instrument. So I
I went with my daughter to Guitar Center today. It's like the first time in maybe 10, 15 years I've been inside of a Guitar Center. And I was looking at guitars on the wall saying, yeah, I had one of those. And I had one of those. And I had one of those. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk. What was it? What was it that you had? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah, sure. A PRS single cut I had.
Oh, my God.
And I had many Gibson. I liked playing the SGs. So I had like three of them.
Wow.
And I never was a Les Paul guy. I got the single cut, and that was pretty much the same guitar. And I really liked playing the single cut. But I never owned a Les Paul. I like playing other people's Les Pauls. I just never owned one. And, you know, I'm basically like a Telecaster Stratocaster guy. And I still have a bunch of those. Yeah.
So you still have a Tele, you still have a Strat. Well, what other guitars did you own? I want to know what was in the collection, the arsenal.
Well, I've had SGs, like I said. I had the single cut. I had a PRS McCarty. I owned, when I was in the band I was in, I bought a bunch of cheaper guitars so that I could just gut them and use them in different keys. Right. So I bought a bunch of Schecters, and I had like five or six different Schecters, and they were only like $400 or $500 guitars, but I put like $400 or $500 worth of electronics into them easily.
That was like that's the hair metal move, dude. Right.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, it was a harder rock kind of a situation. So, and the acoustic guitars I had for the longest time, I had a Gibson Hummingbird.
Oh my God.
I got rid of that too. And I got a J45 instead.
Well, that's a great guitar. That's another great guitar.
I love it. It's fantastic.
So you still have that one?
I do.
So you sold all the other ones. You're just like, okay, I need to get rid of this and buy something else. Or you were just like, I need to just clear stuff out of my closet.
I mean, I had Marshall half stack and a Mesa Boogie half stack and a diesel amplification half stack. I had a bunch of gear. I just didn't need it anymore because I wasn't playing live. And so it's just, I mean, I wasn't recording or anything, and I didn't plan on being in any more bands. I wanted to be on the technical side of things and not on the, you know, the musical side of things so much. Right. So it was just dead weight to me. So I sold it.
So let's talk about that. Like that transition, first of all, that's a big step and a mature decision. But like, when did you know, okay, I want to hang this up and kind of get onto the backside of the records?
I never enjoyed playing live.
Why? Because it's terrifying? Like nerves?
No, that wasn't it at all. I just felt like it was a bunch of
malarkey.
posing, and, you know, I wanted to write music because I loved it. Right. And I wanted to record music. And I spent 6 months in the recording studio mixing four songs because I didn't want to stop mixing the four songs. So, I just knew that that's what I liked to do. And I mean, I loved writing and creating, and I loved rehearsing. I thought sitting in the room with the boys and a 12 pack of beer and, you know, coming up with ideas and getting to know other musicians, you know, in the way you do when you play with them all the time was fantastic. But getting up on stage, I mean, I didn't get off on it.
The funny thing is, like, you know, it's interesting you say that because, like, I always tell my band, like, our rehearsals are so much more epic than our performances. And I enjoy them just like what you just said. There's something maybe it's a controlled environment. Maybe that's why I like it. Like, you control the sound, you know how the sound in that room. And it's like, you know the room, you know the gear. Everything's kind of in place and everybody has their spot in the room. But, you know, on a stage, everything changes and the sound changes and the room changes and the audience changes and, you know, all of those factors. And so I always tell the band, I'm like, if people can hear 80% of our rehearsals in a performance, we've done our job. But I mean, always the rehearsals are going to be more epic and more polished. And it's always like that. So I understand.
It's an atmosphere that's more conducive to creating and coming up with stuff. You're not trying to come up with something when you're on stage. I mean, if you do, it's probably pretty cool.
Right.
But it doesn't happen very often, unless you're in like Dave Matthews Band or something.
Well, you know, it's like, I feel like those are like the road warriors when they become second nature and they do that. But there is this other factor where it's like, there's anxiety, there's adrenaline, there's loading in, there's like chaos. I don't know how or why, but there's always like some loony part of playing live that I'm sure you hated.
I was always more afraid that my gear was going to get stolen. Right. And I like never wanted to leave my stuff. Right. And then I didn't want to, like, the minute we were done, I didn't want to hang around because it was in the back of my truck and I wanted to get out of Dodge so nobody would break in. You hear these stories all the time of peak guys' gear that gets stolen out of their van or out of their truck. I didn't want to be one of those guys. So I would play and get off stage and say, see ya, and just leave and go home. Of course, I had kids at home and stuff too. And, you know, when you have a family, that certainly isn't conducive to playing lots of gigs and doing all that stuff unless you are making a ton of money doing it.
Right. Well, so then you make this change and you started engineering and mixing tracks. When did you make the transition to mastering? Because that's a different bag. Like, you know, you and I have talked about this. I'm like, oh man, I'd love to hear you mix something. You're like, nah, man. Like that's,
I have a producer's mind, not a mixer's mind. And most of the mixers I know are so versed in gear, and they'll sit and talk to me and they'll start talking compressors and plugins, and it goes right over my head. I don't understand what the H they're talking about. I don't want to sit around in AB different limiters. Like that doesn't appeal to me at all. I want to say, you know what? This should sound like this. Do that for me. So
you and I think the same, man.
Yeah, so that's what I enjoyed about being in the recording studio. And I was in a really good recording studio and I was really enjoying my time there and working with excellent engineers. So it's not like I didn't know how to tell them what to do and how to help do what they were doing. I just was enjoying the fact that they were there to do that work for me. And the transition to mastering was easy because I was at the mastering studio the whole time I was in the one band I had that actually did something. And before that, I was working at a record store as a record store manager. So it was just awesome. Like I was always around music in some way. And the record store job was fantastic for being in a band because, I mean, you just make your schedule around any gigging or rehearsing you had to do.
Now, a lot of people don't know, like, I know what mastering is. You know what mastering is, but for the layman, for the people that don't know what mastering is, explain like in a mastering for dummies way how mastering affects a song or a finished album or track.
Well, first of all, I appreciate you assuming I know what mastering is.
You do very well.
So when you're done in the recording studio and everything's been laid down and all the mics have been set and everybody's happy with all of that, and then it goes into the hands of the mixer and between the producer and the mixer, they put it together so that it sounds as coherent as it possibly can. It's not ready to be listened to by the public because it hasn't been put through that final stage where you can give it all of the gain that it needs so it's loud enough. Where you can give it all of its final EQ so that everything that was put in there in the first place can be articulated through whatever medium you're selling it at, a wave or a CD or an LP or what have you.
Or a cassette tape.
And the mastering engineer is the guy who takes those final mixes and puts them through his process, whatever that may be, so that it comes out the other end sounding as loud, as clear, as you know, I mean, depending upon what the producers want, if they want it to sound clear and clean, or just it's a way to add detail, EQ, and gain to the project so that when you hear it on the radio,
it's you know, for the first part of my career, I used a lot of really well-known mastering engineers, and I won't name who they are, but I learned so much in each stage. But I always used to listen to these masters and just think, man, I just know it can be better than this. I just know it can be better than this because I put so much time into these mixes. And then, you know, a lot of mastering engineers, they'll overcompress. And I had to learn what compression does to a mix and how that, you know, can kind of change how big a record or a track or, you know, a collection of tracks can sound. And when I came to you and Bernie initially, and you guys did Music of the New Day, and you and I sat and talked for the first time, and you were doing all the mastering on Music of the New Day, I just remember thinking, this is going to be good. Like the room screams the sounds back to you in a way that you're like, there's no way this is going to sound bad. And I remember getting that master back the first time, and I was like, unbelievable. And the one thing about your work, Joe, that's really incredible, you know, we just did Revolutions this year. You actually just gave me my instrumentals recently. And I have to say, 2 years
after I told you I'd give them
to you. No, but they got done, man. And I got to tell you, even listening to the instrumentals, I was like, I don't know how he does it. Like every time you master something that I give you, you completely elevate the track, and it's just like such a relief actually to have found you and know that you do such an incredible job on NK Band music, Element music, and all these songs. But it's also like, I have to tell you, it is a relief because, you know, when you're navigating through this industry and trying to find mastering engineers, you don't really understand the level of mastering that they do and how they can manipulate a song in the wrong way until you listen back and hear how it's not correct. And there really is a correct way to master and an incorrect way to master. And there's so many, I know that, you know, you and I have talked about this. There's so many people in the mastering part of the industry that some of their work, I just don't understand and comprehend and see how they're on some records. But you know what? When I see the track record that you do have, and you know the engineers also have Bernie Grumman, including Bernie, it totally makes sense why you guys have the records under your belt. Let's talk a little bit about that. So we're going to showcase a track from U2, How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb, one of my all-time favorite records. And we're going to showcase one of my all-time favorite tracks as well. You did Britney Spears. You did Outkast Speaker Box. You did Van Halen. You've just done some of the biggest bands, pop artists in the industry. That's got to be a moment where you kind of pinch yourself like, this is pretty cool. I really dig my gig. And I see some of your Instagram posts every now and then. You're like, I dig what I do. This is what I love. There's got to be those pinch me moments that make you feel like you've arrived. Tell me what some of those experiences are like working on some of your heroes' records or people that you really love whose music they've trusted you with.
Okay. Do you want me to go back in time or recently?
No. Go back in time. Let's see. I want the whole story, dude.
Well, the U2 one is pretty interesting because I was just in the studio on a normal, it was a Thursday night. And outside you know how there's a little window in the door? Outside the little window, I saw Bernie standing there talking with a woman. And then Bernie came in the room and said, we have a woman here who works with U2, and they need a song mastered for the Super Bowl. And it's going to be used in the halftime show. And I said, okay. And he said, I want you to do it. And I said, okay. So she came in, and she actually came in with a mastering engineer that had been working with U2 for a long time. But I don't think that he had done anything recently, and he didn't know our studio or the speakers or the room or the gear. So they gave me Vertigo, and they said, master this track. We need it by, you know, Sunday. So they part of the reason why they said I could do the job was that I said I would go in whatever they needed, like over the next 3 days, I'll just be whatever you need. And so we mastered it and sent it to The Edge, who makes all of the decisions for the band as far as the sound goes. I think they actually all make it, but he's the last word, I guess. Right. And he just liked the way it sounded. And it sounded, in my opinion, very different than anything U2 had released before. Because I was it's an aggressive song, and I was aggressive with the mastering of the song.
Well, and it's also the mix is like awesome, but the mastering, it's like one of those tracks that's just perfect.
Well, you know? I don't think U2's albums were mixed like rock or mastered like rock albums. I thought they were
like arena rock.
They were mastered like they were classic rock records. Like you get all this detail and all of this sound, and it's not very loud and it's not very in your face. And that song is as loud and in your face as can be. So I mastered it that way, and they liked it and they used it. Then after the Super Bowl, I thought I was done. They came back in and they had like 14 more songs.
Started
mastering song after song after song. I mean, I don't remember all the songs on that album off the top of my head, but Then I was
City of Blinding Lights is one of my all-time favorite tracks.
Yeah, that's a really, really cool song. And then there's one song on there that Bono wrote for his dad, and I can't remember.
Yes, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and it was so touching, and I loved mastering that song. But at that time, they brought that mastering engineer, his name was Ernie Acosta, and he came in the room, and I started teaching him how to use the room. And so by the time we were three quarters of the way done mastering that record, we were co-mastering the record.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, which is fine. I mean, I didn't mind. The only thing I minded was that I didn't get a Grammy out of it, and he did.
That's bullshit. Wow.
Yeah. You know, that is what it is. You know, industry stuff. Anyway, had I petitioned had I had the smarts to petition the Grammy Foundation within 12 months of the release, I would have gotten a Grammy, but I didn't think to do so. I just went ahead and kept going about my business and
working. Well, maybe I can help remedy that because I'm an Academy member and I can bring that up.
I'm an Academy member. Don't worry. You don't even need to. I wrote a letter and I talked to somebody there, and they said that the rule is the rule and there's no bending it for anybody. And I said, okay. And that was it. Doesn't matter. Anyway, that wasn't even I didn't have an I made it. I've never had an I made it feeling, because the minute I started mastering records, I just felt like I belonged to the mastering community. So I can't tell you I had I made it. I have mastered stuff for, like, most recently, I mastered Steve Vai's latest record that's going to be out in
January. Oh my God.
And I grew up idolizing that guy. So getting a chance to talk to him and collaborate with him and master for him, that was fantastic. I love
There's your moment right there, dude. There's your moment right there.
Yeah, but it was a great moment, but it wasn't I've made it moment. You know what I mean?
But you're working with your heroes. It's like you idolize.
That's happened a couple times. I did an album for the Afghan Whigs, and Greg Dulli was in the room, and I grew up really liking the Afghan Whigs. I went through a huge, you know, alt punk kind of a phase when I was in my 20s, and he was in a band that was the Afghan Whigs was one of my favorite bands, and I mastered for him. I mastered that record, and that was every bit as enjoyable as the Steve Vai record.
So do you tell them that you're fans of them, or you just like play it cool?
I didn't tell Steve Vai I was a big fan.
You should, man.
Near Greg Wirth, he knows. Right. But with the Afghan Whigs, I was swapping stories with him of shows that I went to where I got kicked out for stage diving and stuff. So he thought that was awesome. And he thought, who better to master my record than somebody who dove off the stage while I was playing? So,
yeah. Well, let's play Vertigo. This is the track one that we're going to showcase. This is U2, How to Dismantle Atomic Bomb, Vertigo, mastered by Joe Bosey.
Turn it up, Captain. Lights go down, it's dark. The jungle is your head. Can't rule your heart. A feeling so much strong. You're then a thought, your eyes are wide, and though your soul. Dripping sky of ink with gold. They twinkle as the boys play rock and roll. They know that they can't dance. At least they know I can stand the feats. I'm asking for the check. Girl with crimson nails is Jesus round her neck. Swing into the music. Swing into the music.
just give me what I want, and no one gets hurt.
Amazing, dude. What is so crazy is you did that song and then it's all over iTunes, Apple commercials, etc., etc. That must have been a cool feeling, like A, having your hands on YouTube's music before the world heard it, B, seeing it splashed everywhere in every Apple commercial. I remember that song just being everywhere. That had to be a cool feeling, right?
Yeah, it is. That song, there's three songs I hear everywhere that I had a piece of, and I hear it all the time. Hey Yeah. Every time I hear that song, I remember mastering that song. So I've heard that one a million times, obviously. That song and I think the song's just called Work by Britney Spears. You want a Bugatti? You want a hot body? You better work. It's such an aggressive song, and it's in commercials. You can't go to the gym without that being in the background. So I hear that one all the time, too.
Did you ever get to a point, like, did you have to master them numerous times? Like, were there changes, or was it like you did it
once? We got deep into that U2 record, we went back and forth a bunch of times, but that's just because they were changing mixes, too. You know how that goes.
Yep.
Mastering brings out things in a mix that maybe people would like to change once they hear it maximized. So there was a lot of mix remixing and revisions on their part, and revisions on my part as well. Sure.
And do you remember, I mean, this might be a nerdy question, but do you remember how many mixes thereabouts were of each song that they did?
Dude. So when it was, U2 are a very different kind of client. When I mastered a track, they wanted to hear like five different versions, and I don't have five different versions.
Right.
So I would master it the way I wanted it to sound, and then I would come up with four alternative masterings that were different in some way, and I would label them that way, like more top end or more bottom end or more present vocal. Because I don't master things, you know, for people five different times and say, hey, pick the one you like the most. Because that's a little ridiculous if you ask me. I master it one time and say, do you like this? Great. If you don't, tell me what you don't like about it and I'll fix it. You know what I mean?
And you know what's also awesome? It's like, you know, I know I've gone through this with you. Your work is like ahead of what the artist may be aware of. The way that it should sound. When I say that, you know, like I say this because, you know, when you have to grow with the mix and you'll sit with the mix and you'll kind of, you know, go with it. And I love that every time, you know, you send me something mastered, you're like, sit with it for a few days, because you have this initial response as like, oh, I had my hands on it at every point. Okay. Why is it doing this? Why is this doing this? And then you sit with it. And literally I have this moment every time where I'm like, God damn, he's a genius, dude. Because I sit with it, and it's not that you get used to it. It's like you start to notice all the details that make it so great, and you start realizing, I didn't hear all those things initially, because you just hear the blast of it first, you know?
Well, there's no doubt that you could listen to you could have three of your own songs, Nikki, and you'd hand them to me, and you've been listening to these three songs for, say, a couple months or even a year, say. And you're hearing the same things that you're always hearing. And you're remembering how you recorded it. You're remembering the guitar lick you spliced in instead of the one that was original in there. And I'm hearing it fresh for the first time. I don't have any of that information that you did. And I'm hearing it completely differently. I'm not hearing the things that you listen for. I'm hearing the things that I listen for. And that's where I think, as a mastering engineer, my producer mind kicks in. because I'll say I'm hearing something and there's like a Hammond organ in it. And I'm thinking to myself, that Hammond organ is playing such an important role in this song, and I don't hear it at all. I'll either kick it back and say, can you send me a mix with a little more Hammond? Or I'll do something in my EQ that'll either enhance the way the Hammond sounds, or maybe even control things that aren't the Hammond so that the Hammond sticks out a little bit more. I'm just using this as an example. And that's when I tell people, just live with it for a couple of days and tell me what you think after you've lived with it for a while, because I know I'm changing the way that it sounds.
Right.
And
but you're doing the right things too. It's like, there's a track on Revolutions. It's my favorite track I have a couple favorite songs, but there's one that I'm like, this is a great master mix, performance, everything. But the master is what brought out all the colors in the right ways, and it's Power Through the Pain. And it's like, I think my whole life I've been trying to write something that sounded like that. And I had one of my closest friends who'd come to so many shows. He said, man, I listened to the entire record. I love your whole record. He's like, you know, I love all your music. But he's like, when Power Through the Pain came on, he's like, I literally could have just listened to that song for the entire amount of time that your whole record was, because he said, I just couldn't get enough of it. And I said, that's Joe Bosey right there. That's his mastering, because you were able to create this balance and this huge sound without making anything sound super small and compressed so that it's like screaming at you. It's like it kept this warmth and this kind of like perfect balance of all these elements. And it's like there's moments where you hear the Hammond organ and then you hear this pedal steel guitar, and even the musicians that played on it, they all sent me texts saying, man, this is such a great record, or this track, you know, this particular one. Is one of the pedal steel players, Ryan Rifkin, he actually sent me a message about that song, and he was just like, it's just so perfect. And I was like, dude, this guy's played with Bruce Springsteen and Tom Petty. If he says that, then you know it's a job well done. So, yeah, it's a testament to, like, how you're hearing it. And here's my other question. Uh-huh. How are you hearing it? What are you listening for? What are the things that trigger you making decisions when you're mastering?
That's a loaded question, because it's not the same every time. I get tracks handed to me that I think sound just fine, and that I don't, like, nothing gets triggered, I guess that's the right word, as, oh, this feels out of whack, or I need to do this, or I need to do that. With your album, and not just that track, the whole album, I told you there's two ways I can approach this, and I wanted to choose the gentler way to approach it, so that I was not limiting it, and giving you the power kind of in a on the back end instead of pushing it hard. And it opened up the songs in a way that I could still make them loud and still make them powerful, but leave all the detail. Like, your waves are all there. I'm not chopping any of those waves off in order to get power out of it. And that's why it sounds the way that it sounds. I knew I wanted to do that because you gave me analog masters. You put a lot of time into it. A lot of the stuff sounded super like in the room. You know what I mean? Like, I would put the album on, and the way it was recorded, it sounds like the drummer's sitting over there and the bass player's sitting over there. And if you squash it, that is gone.
Well, and it's also, you know, I'm sure labels or A&R people, they're always asking you to make, you know, they don't really understand mastering. So that's one of the trials I think you have with what you do. It's like you put like the right touches on something, and then you have some.
So that's interesting, because in the past 6 months, I've done a Rod Stewart record and I've done an Anthony Hamilton record. I've worked on Anthony Hamilton records, a bunch of them, and he's a ridiculously talented R&B soul singing. He's fantastic.
Yeah, he's a badass.
Oh, he's badass for sure. And his producer said, straight up, Anthony loves these mixes, loves the way they sound. So I did. I listened to that. And only in maybe two or three cases on a 12-song record did I turn knobs where I thought I was doing something other than what I was hearing. You know what I mean?
Right.
All the other ones, I just enhanced what was already there. And on jobs like that are super, I mean, I can master 12 songs and 2.5 hours.
Right.
If I'm doing an album where all they want me to do is really make what's already there sound as good as it can, but not change anything. I think I added bass to maybe bottom end to maybe 2 of the 12 tracks, and that was it. Everything else I left, and it sounded fantastic. They did a great job of recording it. It didn't need me to do any more than that. The Rod Stewart album, on the other hand, I heard the same thing, that he really liked his mixes, but when I was listening to them, I still wanted to turn some knobs, so I did, and I didn't get any negative feedback, so.
Well, that's because you put all the right touches on it, man. It's like, and you know what, when you know somebody does those things, I mean, I've had mastering engineers remaster things 3 times. I don't think I've ever asked you to remaster something, which is a testament to how good your work is, because I am like OCD about this stuff, you know? So yeah, it totally makes sense that your instincts are what kick in when they need to, but also, you know, when an artist like wants a mix to sound a certain way, you know, you can just kind of let it go through the motions, and you're going to preserve what's already there, you know? So, and that's, you know, well, that's
yeah, what goes in arts. What goes in comes out. I'm not, you know, it's not like, you know, rocket science what I'm doing. You're getting back what you sent me, only it's sounding as good as it can. That's it.
Well, what's amazing too, it's like when I got my vinyl master for Revolutions, I mean, it's like I couldn't stop. And it was great because I had the CD, I think, for 3 months or like 2 months before I got the vinyls.
Yeah.
So I was just like wearing out the CDs like crazy and listening to them on every medium. Then when I got the vinyl, it was like, oh my God, this is, I mean, I wept. I was like, this is exactly how the tape sounds. And then some, you know what I mean? Which is what your job is. It's like you made the tapes come to life in a way that was like new, and it also preserved everything that's in there. So
well, that credit goes to you and to Doug too.
Doug, I love that, man. Doug's been on the show too. Let's talk about the next track you want to do, Homegrown. Talk a little bit about this track.
I was introduced to these guys, this guy, Alex Marshall, who is in Nashville, and he was making some pop music, some country pop music. And I was blown away with the stuff that he was doing, because it was, you know, it sounded great. Like a lot of the stuff that comes out of Nashville, and I don't get to work on a lot of Nashville projects because Nashville works on Nashville projects. They've got everything they need all right there in that city. So when I do get to work on something from Nashville, I'm thrilled by it. And these kids keep trusting me to work on their music, and I just think they're getting better and better. And I chose them. When you told me to choose bands, I'm not saying this as an exaggeration or to try to sound like I'm some kind of hero or some BS like that. I love working on independent music. It's far more satisfying than working on label driven, A&R driven music. Not to say that I'm not grateful for that, because I would master anything anybody wanted to hire me to master.
Right.
But when you're working for somebody that you know that everything they did came out of their pocket, and some of these people mortgage their house to record their record, yes, and they put a lot of faith in themselves. I've been there. I've been in bands. I know how that feels. You know how that feels.
Exactly.
So those mean a lot to me, and that's this kid's. Yeah, that's this kid's story. The two examples I gave you of the indies, that's both of their stories. They're working with good people. The guys who are now mixing for these guys in Finmar are Jeff Giuliano, who's a ridiculously amazing mixer. Tech, Chris, what's his last name? Oh gosh, I call him Tech. His name's Tech. He works with Justin Bieber. He's amazing. He does a lot of the mixes for this kid. So people are starting to notice him, and I'm lucky enough that I get to master these.
Well, what's awesome too, it's like I asked you to send me 3 tracks, and you're like, yo, I could give you all the big names, but I'd rather just do 3 indies. I'm like, no, do 1 big name or 2 big names and do 1 indie or 2 indies. And you did 2 indies, which I just respect the hell out of you for, because you know what? It's easy. You could have just, oh, here are the biggest bands and artists that I've mastered, and it would be amazing. But you didn't. You were like, let me show you things I love that you may not have heard. And, you know, they're great tracks. So let's play Finmar. This is Homegrown.
Homegrown. Everybody ask me about what it is that she got, because what she got is different. And everybody sees it when she's walking in, yeah. Yeah, the jaws drop in the air, son. If they don't know, they gon' learn. She ain't your typical every other girl. Yeah, my girl is homegrown. Feels like home kinda pretty. You know the kind that make them crazy busy streets in the city. Country, she making drinks on the weekend, tastes like the sweet tea and honey, oh.
New York to LA. And trust me when I say that, hey, nothing like a woman with the roots planted down in some red dirt, country ground, a little homegrown. Feels like home kind of pretty, you know, the kind of make them crazy busy streets in the city feel like a back road. Make you wanna slow down, roll around with them windows down. I'm talking raised on Jesus and coffee. She make them drinks on the weekend taste like the sweet tea and honey.
Slamming track, dude.
Yeah, they're good. They're talented. It's crazy. Thomas Fincham and Alex Marshall.
And you know what's cool? It's like, it's very pop soul. It's like, you wouldn't think that.
Oh, yeah. These guys are. But if you were to listen to some of the other tracks that they have, they're a little less poppy and they've got a little bit more, even though I can hear the country twang in there.
I love country soul so much, and when you have more soul with elements of country or more country with elements of soul, it's like it's like good with good. It's like comfort food. It's like, oh yeah, man, just pour it on, man. Good to good, you know. Yep, so
absolutely.
Yeah. So like when you were mastering that track, did you want to like bring up the kick or like bring out the piano or like vocals, or was it kind of like an easy track to kind of manage and balance?
I mastered it like a hip hop track.
Oh wow! Why is that?
Because I wanted it to hit hard, and they wanted it to hit hard, so it's louder than I usually master. I just a little bit louder than I usually make things, and a little bit punchier than normal pop music would necessarily be. So I kind of gave it a little bit of a hip hop vibe. It's got a little, you know, it's got an R&B beat in it. So,
but it's definitely like Timberlake country, yeah. You know, country.
Yeah. Song, yeah, there you go.
In that vein, you know, but with some really, really hip.
You mean like Timbaland country or Justin Timberlake country?
Like Justin Timberlake, just like
Justin Timberlake and Timbaland and a country band all made a song.
Yes, that's what's awesome. And did you like have to do a couple different versions, or were you kind of like,
this one?
This is it. I like it. Yep. Like, was this a song that you loved, or a single, or you just, this was your favorite track on the record?
It wasn't a whole record. I've done maybe five or six singles. I'm doing three singles for them this week as well. I think, you know, they're putting their brand out there.
That's awesome. And yeah, you know what? It's like, you know this, or you always hear my gripes about it. It's like being an indie artist, it's just not easy. You know, the funny thing is, there's the new Beatles Get Back thing on Disney Plus. Mm-hmm. I've been watching it, and you know, it's what's funny is everybody's raving about it, and I'm sitting there and I'm watching it. I'm like, man, what's really frustrating? It's like watching my favorite band squander all this recording time and this opportunity with like just like band egos and fights.
It's funny because I only watched the trailer for it, and to me, I mentioned to my daughter, it looks like the George Harrison finally gets fed up with Yoko Ono show. That's what it looked like. Dude, from the trailer.
He quits the band, and he does it in a way that's like so polite. He's like, he literally, this is how he quit the band. He said, "All right, well, I'll be leaving now." That's how he quit the Beatles.
George Harrison is my favorite Beatle by far.
Dude, he's like one of the greatest writers of all time. Very underrated in that. Yep. And like, what was so crazy is like, I was, one of the things I was shocked about is like, there's a moment where he's like trying to find the solo. I think the solo is on Get Back.
Oh,
and
okay.
Trying to find like a riff. And he's like, you know, when Clapton, you know, improvises, he just goes for it. He's like, I just don't have that. And I'm like, you don't have that. Like, you have that, because all of his solos are like so through composed and so beautiful. And it's just crazy to hear him say that, because, yeah, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
Let me ask you, you know, a controversial question. Do you ever get asked to master something by a label for a big artist in a way that goes against what you think is proper mastering?
Not really. I mean, I've been asked to make things sound in a way that I would have never naturally done. And then I'll send them something and say, do you mean like this? And they'll say, yeah, that's perfect. And then I'll just master everything else like that. I mean, it's not my project and it's not my decision to make. If they put it in my hands and say, make it sound how you want to make it sound, that's what I do. But if they want to make it sound a certain way, I don't have any problem with that. It doesn't, like, there's no controversy in there. The only controversial thing is when I get asked to master stuff and then I listen to the content and it's against my political beliefs or it's racist or something like that, I've turned jobs like that down.
That's awesome. That's, yeah. That's commendable. I want to ask a nerdy question, because, okay, you know, there are parts of what you do that they're just, it's fascinating. From the 70s, the 60s, or maybe let's take every decade from, like, say, the 50s, like when mastering really kind of was developed.
By Bobby Brennan.
Yeah, right. He was the pioneer of it. You know, he was the very, was it a Sonny Rollins record that was the first?
I don't remember exactly, but every once in a while he'll just tell me a story and my jaw will be on the floor, because he's literally describing how he created mastering while he was cutting lacquer at the same time. You know what I mean? It's like
wild,
dude. Yeah,
I think it was a Sonny Rollins record. I know it was a jazz record, because that's what started.
Oh, for sure. There's no doubt it was a jazz record.
I'm pretty sure it was a Sonny Rollins record. But, you know, how has the technology changed so that mastering can be more detailed? Maybe it's louder. Maybe it's, like, able to be compressed less. Or, like, you know, how has the technology changed to allow you to do maybe more? Or let's counter that, less as well.
Well, digital technology just keeps, we keep being able to deliver more and more information, and more information means more sound, more detail. So when it was just, everything was a cassette tape or everything was a CD, let's say, you're really limited as to the actual quality of what you can hear. Now with the higher bit rates and the higher sampling rates, sure, we truncate everything, and the final product is always a 16:44 or a 24:44 stream, or what have you. But there are, you know, 24:192 and 32:192. Like, we put stuff out there where that, if we weren't able to do that in the 70s and 80s and even 90s for that matter, because it didn't exist. They didn't have the converters that could read that high. They didn't have the gear that could play it back. Now we can. As far as, like, the way that, in directions that it's moving, like, it's moving faster than, like, there's always something different. Like, the ability for you to have gear in your room and make a really quality recording is, I mean, anybody who's willing to invest their time and their money can send me stuff where it sounds just as good as stuff that comes out of $100,000 spent studio,
which is great.
That is where technology has gone, and what has allowed the guy in his bedroom with time, money, and a dream to deliver some really great product in the end. With the way that it's moving with, like, stuff like Sony Atmos and stuff like that.
I was just about to ask you that.
Yeah. So we haven't done any mastering for Sony Atmos, and Bernie isn't too interested in it. Personally, I haven't heard anything on Sony Atmos that I thought to myself, oh my God, this is mind blowing. I need all of this gear now, and I want to hear all of my music this way. It's unnatural sounding.
Well, there's it's no weird. I've heard some mixes on it, and it's like it gives more dimension. But do I think it sounds better? That's tough to say because I think.
Would you rather listen to Christina Aguilera sing "Beautiful" on a recording in your headphones, or would you rather have her sit right in front of you in the room and sing? You'd rather sit right in front of her and hear it. And right. When you're sitting right in front of her and hearing it, she's singing it, and it's going into your ears, your right ear and your left ear, hopefully, because it's in your face and it's coming at you from a direction. It's not coming from all around you and right. On top of you and under you. And that's so like, it's deep, but it's a novelty. And who knows if it'll stick.
That's so awesome that you said that because I was just having this same discussion with Brian Vibberts, who's part of the Element. And, you know, a lot of engineers are prepping for this Utmos.
Oh, yeah. Everybody I know who's a working engineer is working on their room or already has their room ready to go because they want the work.
Right.
You know, U2 is going to put out a record in, you know, a year. And they're going to want to have a Sony Atmos version because people will pay $40 for it.
That's crazy.
Right. Or whatever. I don't even know what they cost, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, let's play this next track, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, Levin Cali. Tell me a little bit about how this artist kind of impacted you or how you picked this artist or this song.
Levin Cali. I love this kid. I was working on an album for this guy named Harlan who runs a recording studio in Venice. And he, why is it my, can you still see me, hear me?
Yeah, I can see you.
He said, I have this kid that came into my studio and I want you to work with him. And I said, okay. And he said, he got a little bit of money from a record label and they're trying to develop him as an artist and I'm going to give him your number. So he gave me his number and he came into my studio himself with his crew and the guys he was working with, all very nice kids, super respectful, super smart, super cool. I believe he's a USC kid.
Oh, of course. That's right.
And I knew you'd say that. And I also think he was like a amateur golfer or something. He's just an interesting guy. And even before I heard anything he could do, I liked him. I was like, we are kindred spirits. I like you. I can't wait to hear your music. And then we did an album called, I believe it was called High Tide. And it was so much fun and he was so talented and the collaboration was wonderful because he was learning and bouncing a lot of things off of me. And I enjoy that. I really do.
You're a wealth of information too. I mean, you did that with me when we did Music of the New Day and that's kind of like where I really understood deeper levels of mastering. I understood mastering, but I really learned and I continue to with everything you do. So let's play this Levin Cali, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Give me 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I just want to feel alive. You sipping, we got everything you want. Ooh, it's a new Lone Mary popping Bella out the roof. Yeah, a little spoonful of sugar. Always have the medicine go down smooth. Feeling like this way too much. I need a wind down, roll one up. But the Benz just pulled up front. You can tell your friends to hop in. I got room for like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I just wanna feel alive.
Amazing. What a great track. What a great groove, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Man, what were the kind of finishing touches you put just to make that kind of pump the way it does?
He's very good at producing and recording his own music. So we did one called High Tide, and then we did one called Low Tide, or vice versa. I can't remember which one came out first. And on the second go round, he wanted it to hit harder. We did the first one really clean. And that's the way they wanted it, was really clean. And the second one, he wanted it to hit a little bit harder. I think that kid's as talented as anybody I work with. He's really good at what he does. And gosh, I hope he just makes $1 billion.
Well, you know, it's like, you can hear it right away. It's like, yeah. You know, I downloaded the track and I was like, dude, this is slamming. It's just a good song. It's a good arrangement. It's a good, you know, showcasing a production,
and he's a really good person. Mastering,
you're right,
which is great.
That's always a perk. You can't always get that.
Well, but it's my favorite part.
Yeah, right.
I'd rather master crappy music for good people than great music for crappy people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you get a mixed bag of all of it.
I do. Yes, of course.
Well, I hope to never be one of the shitty people in your life, but
I would never admit it here on the video.
What a dick! Well, that was a fantastic way to actually end it on. Joe, you've been a wonderful guest on Wake Up Hollywood. I am giving you a revolving door to keep coming back, because I know there's more records you're going to be mastering. I've been waiting so long to ask you the nerdiest of questions. I have many more that I still want to ask you that I'll probably ask you in our own mastering sessions. I'll probably ask you on future records that I do. By the way, you are going to master a new blues trio record that I'm doing. So that's coming your way soon. Cool. But yeah, man, you're just such a pleasure to work with. Just a fantastic interview and person and vibe and music mentor and colleague. So I respect you so much as a friend, and even more as a music collaborator. So lots of love and light to you. Happy holidays. Big hugs all the way around. And, dude, we finally got this interview in the book.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
Touchdown, man. I can't believe it. High 10, man. High 10. Well, keep coming back, because we want to keep asking you questions, and the nerdiest of questions are still on the table. So thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. And, dude, love and light to you and your family, man. And
I'll definitely see you. Have a great holiday.
You too, man. And we'll talk soon, okay?
Sounds good.
Take care. On behalf of Sam, myself, and Joe, we wish you guys the happiest of holidays, and we'll see you guys next week. Peace.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.